Welcome to the podcast of Radius Church. This podcast is presented in the context of our Sunday morning service. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
In August of 2021, in the city of Calabasas, California, there was a mom who heard her five-year-old son screaming out in horror and pain from the front yard, and she runs out and she sees a 65-pound mountain lion dragging her son across the yard. And she immediately, without any thought, I've got a little bit of a ring up here. If we could turn down my mic, that'd be great. She immediately, without thought, she runs and she starts punching and hitting, fighting this mountain lion. And eventually the mountain lion gave up, ran away. And the Game and Fish Parks Department, Captain Patrick Foy, he said, "This mom is an absolute hero who saved her son's life. There's no question about it. She ran outside and immediately started striking and punching at the lion and managed to fend him off of her son." This mom's courage, determination, and willingness to even sacrifice her own life saved her son's life. This morning, we're going to look at another mom whose courage, determination, and willingness to sacrifice actually ended up in taking her son's life. And this morning, we're going to look at John chapter 2. You can turn there if you want. You can take out your notes this morning. And as you're doing that, I want to welcome everyone in the house online, in the house and online. Thank you for being with us. And those moms who are watching online, hope you're having a great day and that you are blessed and encouraged by this message that we're calling A Miracle Mom. A Miracle Mom. In your notes, if you take a look at your notes, the miracle of the water turning to wine, and that's what the story of John chapter 2 is that we're going to be looking at in a little bit of detail today. It happens solely because of a mother's heart. This miracle kicked off Jesus' ministry. From that point on, things were never the same again. And Mary displayed five qualities that led to this miracle. And if we possess these same qualities, not just moms, but all women and men of all ages, then we can ignite a move of God in our community. A move of God where the Lord does miraculous things in people's lives and they are never the same again. And so that's what we're going to look at today is these five qualities that God is looking for in a people, because I believe God wants to move in every city, every community in the world. How many believe that? God has a powerful work that he wants to do. He wants people to know him. But for God to operate in a powerful way, in a great move of God, he has to entrust it to people who can carry it. People of godly character. And I believe that these five traits are things that God is looking for in people, in a church. And he says, can I pour out my spirit? Can I give a spiritual awakening to a community? Can I bring life and the supernatural and transform people's lives? But it takes people who are willing to submit themselves to what God wants to do. And really, it takes these five qualities to produce that type of a move of God. So if you're taking notes this morning, number one is a hard-working, servant-hearted person. That's the first quality that we need, to be hard-working, servant-hearted. And let's pick it up in John chapter 2, verse 1. It says, on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now, Cana was 60 miles north of Jerusalem. It's a smaller town, kind of out in the boondocks, out in the middle of nowhere. This is where the first miracle is going to take place, but we need to realize this was not God's original plan. When you're launching the ministry of the Messiah, you don't do it in Cana. You just don't do it. It was the wrong place for the miracle, for the ministry to take place in. But you know what that tells me? If God can do that in Cana, he can do that in Casper. If God can do that in Cana, he can give a powerful, sovereign move of God anywhere in the world. So God wants to move in and among us. And what took place, and my question is, Jesus was from what city? What was his hometown? Nazareth. He grew up in Nazareth, born in Bethlehem, grew up in Nazareth. So that's where Mary's from. The question is, what is Mary doing in Cana? Because Cana is 7 miles from Nazareth. What's she doing? She is actually working at this wedding. She's working at this wedding. She's hardworking, and this wedding feast was 7 days. Can you imagine working at a 7-day, week-long wedding reception? That's a lot of work. Mary, Bible theologians believe, was related to the bride and groom here. She was related because the only people that worked at weddings were servants and family members. Now, she clearly wasn't a servant because Nazareth was her home. She is just there in the community visiting, so she's probably a family member. But not only is she serving and helping out, Mary has a leadership position. She's over the servants. We see that in verse 5. It tells us in verse 5, his mother said to the servants, whatever he says to do, do it. So Mary is giving them orders. Mary is giving them orders. Now, she is hardworking. She's not just doing stuff herself, but she has to plan. She has to coordinate. She has to think, I need this group of people to do this, this to do that, this to do this. Keep everything going. This is what I want us to ask ourselves this morning. Why is being a hardworking, servant-hearted person important to have a sovereign move of God? Because a sovereign move of God is hard work. It is hard work. Many of you, a couple weeks ago when Pastor Don Ross was here, filled out your My Mission card. We mailed these back to you. If you got your card, raise your hand. Put your hand up in the air. Hopefully you all got your cards. If not, talk to us. How many have been praying for the people on your card that God would use you over the course of these next 2 years? Almost all the same hands are up. That is awesome. Here's my question for you. What happens when when one of these people on here gives their life to Jesus? Is it like, oh, good, scratch off Joe. I don't have to pray for him anymore. I don't have to think about Joe anymore. I'm done with Joe. No. You see, Jesus said, go into all the world and make disciples of all men. Matthew 28:19. We're called to make disciples, not converts. So when someone crosses the line of faith and says, I need to receive Christ, I realize that I'm a sinner. I need God's leadership in my life. I want a relationship with God. When someone does that, now the hard work begins. Now you and I need to go about discipling them. You say, I don't know how to disciple them. I encourage you, when we offer Growth Track, go to Growth Track, because we give the four essential things that will help people to grow in their relationship with Christ. It's a very easy thing to do. So you can bring those people to Growth Track when we offer that. But friends, discipling people is hard work. There's an investment of time, of energy. There may be an investment of money. There is going to be investment of relationship. And that's why people who are hardworking and servant-hearted, that's one of the first qualities God looks for when he wants to send a move of God to a community. So that's the first aspect that Mary possessed, the first quality. The second quality Mary possessed is that she was personable. Mary was personable. Not only was she a great worker, not only was she dependable and reliable, but she could get along with others and work with them. How many of you know people that are really talented or really hardworking, but they're not very fun to be around? Yeah, you know what I mean. You know, they're great workers, but yeah, they just don't play well with others, okay? If we are going to see a sovereign move of God, we've got to play well with others. We've got to actually like people. You've got to like people. It is sad, but there's a couple of authors, David Kinnaman and Gabe Lyons, they wrote a book called Unchristian, and they surveyed 30 years old and under that generation. And you know how they generally view Bible-believing Christians? They see Bible-believing Christians as judgmental, hypocritical, rude, and insensitive. Now, how many of you think that sounds like a formula for winning your community to Christ? No. If that's how people see the church, see Radius, see Christians as being rude, insensitive, judgmental, hypocritical, we are not going to reach the world for Christ. Last Thursday, I received a message, a Facebook message, and then the office received a phone call that someone was driving their vehicle with the Radius sticker on the back, and they cut me off, and they posted on Instagram and Facebook, "This church is rude. They're horrible people. Don't go to this church community. You want to go somewhere else." Ouch. I tried calling the person. They left their message. I called them. They never got back in touch with us. I'm still trying to reach them, trying to repair a bridge. Friends, when we burn a bridge with someone, when we offend someone, hurt someone, it takes a lot of hard work to go back and repair it. So a couple of things. First of all, if you have the Radius sticker on the back of your car, drive nice or take it off, okay? One or the other. But secondly, not just when you drive, but in everything you do. Because most people know that you declare yourself to be a Christian. Many of them might know, hey, you come up to the church on the corner, up here kind of on the hill. And how you and I act towards people can either turn them on or off, not just to the church, but to Jesus. And it can impact them whether or not they want to hear the gospel or not. Well, they're Bible-believing Christians. You know, why would I want to go there? What I want to hear what they have to say. How we treat people is a big deal. Mary was personable. She got along, and so they says, you know what? When we need someone to work with all the servants and oversee them, we need someone who's going to build a team and motivate the team instead of discourage and, you know, just make them feel horrible and bad. Mary was a nice person. And, you know, that's probably pretty, you would think that being the mother of Jesus, when God selects someone, he's not going to pick a grumpy old nasty woman. He picks someone who is nice and kind and friendly, who's going to invest that and pour that in. And so we need to be people that are personable, friendly, kind, amiable, sociable with others. All right, let's take a look at the third quality Mary had, and that was compassion. Mary was compassionate. John chapter 2, verse 3, when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." This is important because the wedding feast could last for up to the week, and the groom's family was responsible for all of the food and beverage for the feast. If they ran out of food, this couple would be disgraced and be the talk of the town for years to come. Every time there's a wedding, hey, you remember the Joneses' wedding when they ran out of food and drink? Remember that time? Remember when that happened? But here's something else. Not only was it a disgrace, but the family could possibly be heavily fined and even excommunicated on the first level from the Jewish synagogue. There were three different levels, and they could be excommunicated. So you're talking about not just, oh, we ran out of food, but they could incur a financial penalty plus a spiritual penalty. And Mary's compassionate. She wants Jesus to do something. She comes to him and says, "They have no wine." And that brings us to one of the most interesting but kind of confusing statements in the Bible, if you've ever read it. What does Jesus say? "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Now, in our culture, if you address a lady by the term woman, that's kind of a little bit of disrespect, isn't it? Woman, get me my dinner. Woman, do this. Woman, I mean, how many would say, ladies, if you're called woman, how many of you want to just slap the person who said that? Be honest now. Maybe you'd say, "I'm too gracious," but they should be slapped. How many say they should be slapped, okay? You're very gracious women. You would never slap someone. But here's the thing. Back in Jesus' time, using the term woman, it was not a sign of disrespect. So we think it's disrespectful, but it wasn't. When Jesus made this statement, there's a few things that are going on. First, he's showing that he's not under the earthly supervision of his mother, but he's under the heavenly supervision of his Father. Secondly, when he says, my hour has not yet come, it represents two things. First, obedience to his Father's will. You see, Jesus was walking in the Spirit, trying to be sensitive to the hour. Father, when is the hour you want me to go public? Because you see, up to this point in time, Jesus has only been private in his personal one-on-one doings. When he saw Nathanael a chapter before, and he says, you were under the tree this morning having your devotions. I saw that. Nathanael's going, wow, this guy, I mean, he's got to be a prophet. He's got to be the Messiah. Jesus was ministering only one-on-one, calling out his team, but he hasn't gone public. And so he is walking in the Spirit, Father, when is my hour? And he knew that this was not the time. Not in Canaan, not in a small little community. This is not the right place. But the second thing, and this is the big thing, Jesus knows that once I do the first miracle, the countdown to the cross starts counting. When I perform the first miracle, the clock starts ticking, and now crucifixion is on its way. And so what Jesus is telling his mom, he's saying, Mom, do you know what you're asking? He says, right now, we've got unlimited time together. The cross is nowhere in sight. The countdown hasn't started. But if you want me to do this miracle, the countdown begins now. You are now saying, I'm going to die. You're putting it in motion. Mom, do you really want to do this? This is not my hour. It hasn't started yet. And what did Mary do? And this brings us to the fourth quality. Mary was sacrificing. She was willing to sacrifice her time with Jesus. She responds in verse 5. When Jesus says, this is not my hour, she says to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Mary knows that even though the countdown to the cross is going to start, she was willing to sacrifice her time with her son to save this family that she cared about, that she loved, that she didn't want them to go through disgrace, a fine, and possible excommunication. She releases Jesus by telling the servants, whatever he says to do, go ahead and do it. Adoniram Judson was a missionary to Burma. He went through a lot of suffering, but he saw 500,000 people come to Christ, and he translated the entire Bible into the Burmese language. And this is what Judson said. There is no success without sacrifice. If you succeed without sacrifice, it's because someone has suffered before you. If you sacrifice without success, it is because someone will succeed afterwards. Mary was willing to sacrifice, and really, this is an attitude, a quality you see in Mary from the very get-go. Because when the angel appeared to her and says, hey, you're going to give birth to the Son of God, she was willing to sacrifice then and there. She was willing to sacrifice her reputation because she knows everyone's going to think I'm an adulteress, that I had an affair, that I wasn't faithful to Joseph. She was willing to sacrifice her reputation. She was willing to sacrifice her wedding plans. She knew there's a possibility that when Joseph finds out I'm pregnant, he's not going to believe me, that I am a virgin still, that this is the Son of God. There's a possibility that Joseph is going to divorce me, put me away, because when you're engaged, a betrothal, you had to break it, you had to get a divorce. Even though you weren't actually married and haven't consummated the relationship, it had to be a divorce. And there's one of two things you could do when you divorce someone. You could either have them stoned or have them be put away quietly. Joseph was going with the other one. And Mary, she had to believe that, well, if I'm going to give birth to the Son of God, I'm not going to get stoned. But I just might be a single mom. And I might lose the man of my dreams, the love of my life. And she was willing to sacrifice her entire future to be the mother of the Messiah. And friends, we need to be a people who are willing to sacrifice our dreams and our time and our finances to see a move of God. If we're not willing to sacrifice to see God move in a powerful way, we're not going to see a powerful move of God. And that's a decision that I, as a pastor, I can't make for you. Each and every one of us have to make that decision for ourselves. Are we going to be hardworking servants? Are we going to be personable, friendly, sociable? Are we going to be compassionate and get involved in other people's lives when we see they've got a need? I'm just going to stay over here and not get involved. No, I'm going to enter into the fray and get involved and meet their needs, even if it means I have to sacrifice some things. You see, these are the qualities that kicked off the miracle that brought about the ministry of the Messiah. And then there's one last quality that we see in Mary, and that she had faith. Mary had faith. In verse 5, she said, "Whatever he tells you to do, servants, do it." Whatever it is, it doesn't matter how ridiculous, it doesn't matter how impossible it seems, do it. Mary had faith that Jesus could do the impossible. And friends, we need that attitude in our lives that no matter the problem, no matter the situation, God's got this. All things are probable? No, possible with God. How deep is your faith? When you suffer, when you go through a financial issue, do you lose your faith? When you go through a health issue, do you lose your faith? When you experience a personal crisis, maybe you're dealing with something, an addiction, you're dealing with depression, you're dealing with some sort of inner battle, inner struggle that you've had, do you just give up on God when it gets tough? Friends, I want you to know that no matter what you're going through, God is with you. He loves you. He wants to be your friend. He wants you to put your full trust in faith in him. We're told in James to count it all joy when you go through various trials. All joy. And I have to confess, I got to work on that because I do not have joy in every single trial. When that radius driver cuts me off, I don't know. They haven't done that. But when other drivers cut me off, I don't always have joy. I'm not always personable. And you see, God wants our character to be people that can bring about and sustain a powerful move of God in a community. We've got to be people of faith. If we've got faith in our life, then the joy of the Lord is our strength and it carries us through anything. We're trusting and believing in God in every situation. In this story, there wasn't just one miracle, but there were several miracles. And I want to read verses 6 through 11 and then unpack some things here. So join me as we read verse 6. It says, "Now there was set there six water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, 'Fill the water pots with water,' and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, 'Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast.' And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, he did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom. He said to him, 'Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now.'" Verse 11, "This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." This wedding was being held in a banquet area, a large area. There were six water pots that held 20 to 30 gallons apiece. And what took place is these water pots were for public drinking consumption. They didn't have drinking fountains back then. So when you wanted a drink, you would go, you'd ladle some out, you'd get a drink. That was the drinking water. But the thing is, this water, it was kept in stone pots. And we'll see why that's significant in just a moment. It's kept in stone pots because as they're placed around the city, no matter how hot it is, it would keep the water cool. Now, there was no water purification plants back in those days. So water had to go through a purification process. They would put the water in the pots. They would fill them on Friday. Saturday, the Sabbath, they would leave them alone. They would not touch them. But then starting on Sunday, for the next few days, all the way till the next Sabbath, they would skim off the impurities. Some impurities, the heavy ones, would settle down to the bottom of the pot, and then others would float to the top. Twice a day, they would skim off the impurities. And on Saturday, the second Sabbath, the next one, they would let the pot sit again. And then on Sunday, they would skim off the impurities one more time. Only then, after this process, only then was the water considered pure and good to drink. So that's the process that these water pots had to go through. So what took place? I want you to see the five miracles. We have them listed there in your notes. The first one is that Jesus places a protective film between the water and the stone jar. Because you see, the stone jar would turn the wine, when it became wine, it would turn it acidic. It would contaminate it and ruin it. So Jesus puts this protective film so when it does become wine, that it doesn't become contaminated. Next, Jesus turns the dirty water into clean water. And then Jesus turns the clean water to wine. Now, something you need to realize here. Some people have looked at this verse and say, hey, Jesus turned the water to wine. He must approve of drinking of alcohol. Well, we can't say that definitively here, because in the Greek language, the word for grape juice, like what you get the Welch's at the store, and the word for wine, it's the same Greek word oinos. And so it just depends on the context if it's referring to unfermented grape juice or fermented grape juice, which is wine. You don't know. When it says in the Bible they drank new wine, then that would be referring to the grape juice. But when it just says oinos, it's kind of unclear. So just realize that if you ever talk to someone and they say Jesus turned water to wine, it could have been grape juice. But regardless if it was grape juice or wine, that's a miracle. He turned simple water into the fruit of the vine. The fourth miracle that took place is the wine is of superior quality. It's the best that the governor had tasted. And friends, I want you to realize, when God does a work, man, it's of superior quality. When God works in your life and my life, and here's the thing, there are times when God's worked in my life and I look at it and I say, wait a second, God, that's not the way it was supposed to be. How many have ever questioned God and what he's doing, his activity in your life? How many have ever done that before? Many of you have. I want you to realize that even if it doesn't seem like God was doing what is best, his work is always superior quality. In fact, a lot of times his work has the long game in view. We go for the short game, the immediate, the quick success. God's looking for the ultimate good, and many times that takes a while for you and I to realize. And that's why we need to be people of faith. We've got to trust him that he's working all things together for good. And then the last miracle is that the wine runs for the rest of the week. And friends, what I want us to realize with this is that God always gives enough. God always gives enough. It may not appear like enough, but look what he did with five loaves and two fish. He fed thousands. He took six water pots with dirty, impure water, and it was enough. God is always enough if you put your faith in him. You know, those servants, I wonder what they're thinking, because here's the thing. They could have been executed for giving the governor this nasty water. They knew where this water had come from. They knew this water shouldn't be tampered with for a week. They knew it's nasty. But yet, his mama said, whatever he says to do, we gotta do. So they dip it in. They take it to the governor. He says, man, this is the best. Wow. Are you and I willing to be made looking like a fool or even sacrifice our life for God? Is that the kind of faith you and I have? Because you see, when we're people who are hardworking servants, we're personable, we're compassionate, that we are, help me out here, sacrificing, and finally, full of faith. You know what can happen? God can say, I see these people that I can trust with the sovereign move of God. I can do miracles. I can transform people's lives. I can take people who are dirty and impure, people who may look like some of the worst of society, and I can transform them into superior quality, making them pillars of the community. That's the power of the gospel. That's the power of a work of God. And God's just looking for a group of people who would say, you know what? God, sign me up. I want you to use me in a powerful way in other people's lives. Pray with me this morning. Father God, I thank you for this story. The story that maybe some of us have read many times before, but today you've given us a different insight into it. And I pray, Father, that right now your Spirit will be speaking to each of us. God, show us what you want to do in our lives.
You have been listening to the podcast of Radius Church in Casper, Wyoming. For more information, please check us out at radiuschurch.live or call us at 307-265-9121. We hope you've enjoyed this presentation.